From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. A unique life ended this weekend, someone you might not think you know. His name was Kim Peek. He was 58 years old. He died of a heart attack in suburban Salt Lake City. Kim Peek was the inspiration for the Dustin Hoffman character in the 1988 film Rain Man. He memorized almost everything he read and he heard, and he did this despite severe mental handicaps. NPR's Howard Berkus has this remembrance.
Kim Peek couldn't operate a light switch and he couldn't button his shirt, but his memory was so vast and deep and exact.
He was in a way a bit like a computer. In fact, there were those who called him Kim-puter.
Daniel Christensen is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Utah's Neuropsychiatric Institute. And during the last 20 years, he examined, tested, and traveled with Peek.
He had a bottomless memory. Of course, that's really little more than recalling a fact. Then the ability to reason with them, to make sense of them, to know the implications, to make judgments based on them, that's a very different thing. And that's sort of where his mental abilities ended.
Peek was born without the bundle of fibers that connect the right and left hemispheres of the brain, but he mastered details about history, math, music, geography, and more. Most savants have a single focus. In 1988, Dustin Hoffman portrayed a character based on Peek in the film Rain Man. Here, Hoffman's character frustrates his brother, played by Tom Cruise, because he refuses to get on a plane.
American Flight 625 crashed April 27, 1976.
We don't have to take American. There's a lot of flights.
Yeah, take another airline.
Continental.
Continental crashed November 15, 1987. Flight 1713, 28 casualties.
The movie made Peek famous as the real Rain Man, and he was the subject of hundreds of articles and documentaries. This German film includes a scene in which American history students test Peek's memory.
This is my birthday, August 5th, 1947.
It was a Tuesday, and this year it's a Friday, and you retire in 2012 on a Sunday.
And what was the best picture when she was 15?
Lawrence of Arabia.
That's right.
Even NASA studied Peek, whose memory was sharp to the end. It was his heart that gave out this weekend. Daniel Christensen says there has never been and may never be another savant like Kim Peek. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
Looking back on 2009, it's been a year when reality television and real life collided, and mostly in embarrassing and in some cases dangerous ways. The Balloon Boy is one such example. Earlier this year, his parents falsely claimed their 6-year-old son was carried away in a homemade balloon. The parents will be sentenced today for charges stemming from that hoax. To review this and other events, we reached New Yorker TV critic Nancy Franklin. Good morning.
Good morning, Linda.
Now, this family, the Balloon Boy family, appeared twice on ABC's reality TV show Wife Swap. And in an affidavit, the mother admits they fabricated this story to make the family, quote, more marketable for future media interest. And they weren't the only ones who were going to great lengths to seek fame this year.
No, that's absolutely right. It's a rather long list, actually. Of course, you've got John and Kate from John and Kate Plus 8.
We got to see their marriage blow up.
We got to see their marriage blow up. Actually, mostly blew up in the tabloids and in Us Weekly between seasons. And so when the last season started, TLC got fabulous ratings. And more tragically, we had Ryan Jenkins, who'd been on VH1 reality show, Megan Wants a Millionaire. He killed his ex-wife, who was a model in Los Angeles, and then ran away to Canada and committed suicide. Now, this is a guy who had a previous assault charge in Canada. And, you know, it's very easy to find out whether somebody has a criminal record or not.
Well, do you suppose this means that the networks and the cables ought to reconsider their reality lineup or maybe be a little more careful about who they invite on their programs?
Well, I think they should.
But on the other hand, they're making money?
Well, on the other hand, they're making money. And also, in a way, they really can't reconsider because what else are they going to fill the space with? I mean, most of programming today is reality TV.
This is making our own Washington example look positively benign, where the two people infuriated the Secret Service and many other people by crashing a White House state dinner, the Salahis.
That's right, the Salahis.
Famous lady in the red dress.
The lady in red. Almost classy by comparison, and that's really saying a lot because they're anything but. I mean, these people seem to have a history of scams behind them. Now, they were being filmed for possible inclusion in the Bravo reality series, Real Housewives. This would have been Real Housewives of D.C.
I don't like to think about it.
I know. But we must, Linda, we must think about it.
Do you think that that there's a continuing audience for this kind of infamy, or do you think there's a point at which audiences will say, enough?
No, I don't think that there are people who are continually interested, but I think that it's easy to get our attention, and it's easy to lose it. I think this kind of stuff has always been with us. I mean, if people who used to go over Niagara Falls in a barrel,
yeah.
If they could have had television cameras there 100 years ago, they would have. I mean, this is, there's a natural kind of curiosity, but some of this really is harmless. And as television stations themselves like to say, well, you can always turn it off.
Nancy Franklin watches and reviews television for The New Yorker. Thank you very much for this.
Thanks, Linda.
We travel even further into the past for our next story. If you grew up watching television in the 60s, this might sound familiar.
Danger, danger, Will Robinson. Which way did they go, partner?
The robot from the television show Lost in Space still has a small but intense following, and some old fans are paying big money to try to relive part of their childhood. From South Dakota, Johanna Saylor reports.
As a young child, Mike Joyce dreamed of two things: being an astronaut and owning his own robot from the show Lost in Space. Now 48, the retired Air Force pilot is sad he hasn't been to space. But Joyce beams as he shows off the features of the Lost in Space robot replica he designed and built by hand.
I was very famous at one time. Now I am retired. And I just stand here most of the time and look really cool.
It started as a hobby, then it became a business selling these replica robots. His factory is in his home's basement. Surprisingly, Joyce is able to build these highly detailed 275-pound robots far from any support services deep in South Dakota's Black Hills Forest. Even though Joyce makes a living building these replicas and has a model of the show's rocket in his backyard, he doesn't consider himself an obsessed fan.
Some people would say if you had a model, a life-size model of the Jupiter 2 in your backyard, that you're an obsessed fan, I suppose.
Either way, Joyce isn't alone. He's already sold 53 robot replicas. Each can take 2 months to build and sell for $25,000. Richard Molnar of Vancouver bought one of them and is thrilled to own it.
My robot still appeals to me because the 21st century turned out to be crashingly boring, and I still do not have a flying car.
Robot creator Mike Joyce still dreams of flying to the moon. So much so, he's now investing in another project. This one is about real space science and aims to land a robotic rover on the moon. For NPR News, I'm Johanna Saylor in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Xbox, PlayStation, and Wii continue to top holiday wish lists this year. But while electronics remain popular, a low-tech corner of the game industry is also doing well. From member station WNKU, Sherry Lawson reports.
If you think board games are boring, think again.
So all you do is roll the die, and that's where you have to put your egg.
On a recent evening, fans of board games gathered in Cincinnati to play together.
Awesome.
Every night is game night at YottaQuest, a family-owned store. 5 years ago, Matthew Fay opened his game shop, and since then, his business has increased 25% a year on average. Even during the recession, sales are up 40% compared to last year.
There's no video games in here at all. No video games, no electronic games. This is all personal interaction between people. Yeah, the game's one thing, but the socializing is a key part.
Yes! Awesome!
Shelves are stocked from floor to ceiling with games such as Monopoly and Apples to Apples, even European favorites like Settlers of Catan. Toy manufacturers and major retailers won't disclose national sales figures, but industry insiders say board game sales increased by more than 20% last year. They're expected to be even higher this year.
One of the main reasons why board games are doing so well has to do with the economy.
Jim Silver is editor of TimeToPlayMag.com, a consumer website.
You can buy a great board game for under $20, and every time you play it, it's a new game. This is a toy that could be played over and over again, so the consumer sees value in this type of purchase.
On this night, a mixed crowd fills the tables in the YottaQuest store. Players from ages 12 to 60 are enjoying the latest strategy games like Pandemic. They include students, homemakers, research scientists, and a few who are unemployed. Not all of them are so-called game geeks. In this economy, some gamers have given up cable TV and eating out. And others, like Karen Miller and her husband, have cut down on going to movies.
By the time you buy two tickets and your popcorn and your drinks, you're spending $30-$40. And I can buy a board game for about that much money and play it over and over again.
In this era of computers and online networking, some people who play together become addicted to human contact. That's true of 23-year-old Brian Girding, who used to spend hours on the Internet.
Like, I can play online games where I'm talking to people, but these people are right there.
Real people.
Real people, yeah.
Face to face.
Yes, exactly. It makes a big difference in the game.
Store owner Matthew Fay is convinced the community aspect of face-to-face gaming is what will keep people buying and playing board games even when the economy improves. For NPR News, I'm Sherry Lawson in Cincinnati.